good evening. Welcome to Tom Harris USA, episode number 28. This is Tom Harris in Chicago, Illinois, in a sticky Chicago evening, made stickier by the fact that I had to turn the fan off in order to record this show. So the last couple of episodes, I spent quite a lot of time researching and doing all the stuff. So now it's time to get caught up. I have a lot of comments here, and I'm going to get to all of them, I hope. But before I do, Irving actually kind of jogged my memory because I saw that he had posted a Facebook comment about his neighbor's dogs getting skunked. Ooh, there's nothing worse than that, is there? It happened to my dog twice, and I was living at that time. I was living in Cleveland. Yeah, not like out in the country somewhere. I was actually living in Cleveland. Now, granted, Cleveland Heights, which is the area that I lived in, has a lot of trees and a lot of green, especially when you compare it to my neighborhood here in Chicago. But you don't expect to find very much wildlife in that kind of environment. But there we had the usual urban animals that you occasionally find, and there'd be things like possums, raccoons, rabbits, squirrels, and so forth. But in my neighborhood, we had a family of skunks. And they did kind of spread around the neighborhood, so occasionally you'd see them, especially at night. Skunks are nocturnal, obviously. But a couple of times, and I had a route that I would take the dog on, and we had a Rottweiler, and his name was Bear. And Bear and I would go, we had a regular route that we would take. I'd walk him for about a mile in the evening. And twice he got skunked. Both times I was with him, both times he saw the skunk and I didn't. And the first time it was actually kind of nastier because it was a more kind of a widespread spray. I think I even got some on me. He kind of surprised a skunk that was rummaging around in somebody's trash. And it was like a December evening and it was, you know, almost freezing out and it was raining. And I had to go to the grocery store at midnight and get big can of tomato juice and dog shampoo, and they didn't have the anti-skunk stuff. It was just like a regular dog shampoo. And I had to bring it home, and I smelled of skunk, too, because I got caught in the crossfire, and had to give the dog a bath in the driveway of the house with tomato juice and dog shampoo and in this freezing rain, and it was just awful. And a dog didn't care. That's the funniest thing. You know, he wasn't in distress at all. He didn't care. In fact, he was enjoying the hell out of it. He was all excited. He's like, tomato juice! And he was licking it off the ground. what a silly dog he was. The second time he got sprayed, and it was only a few months later. It was in the spring after the babies were born. And he found a baby skunk, and he tried to pick it up in his mouth. Once again, this happened very, very quickly, and I didn't have a chance to react. He kind of lunged forward, and he had the rear end of the baby skunk right in his mouth, and it sprayed him right in his mouth. And poor dog. That time he actually was a little distressed, and he just drooled and had skunk breath for a long time. But I did what I could, you know. What do you do? Yeah, I fed him tomato juice. How do you deodorize skunk off the breath of a dog? It's impossible. So there is urban wildlife kind of everywhere, including Chicago. And here in Chicago, we have the usual suspects, of course, the possums and the squirrels and raccoons. And we don't have as much of a variety. We don't have deer, for example, living in the inner city where I am. But we do have coyotes, and I saw one just the other day hanging out down by one of the alleyways. It was kind of a block away from the lake, and I was coming home from work, as I often do, on foot, and I saw this coyote rummaging around in somebody's garbage. So they are here, and every once in a while they put an article in the newspaper about the urban wildlife. So if you live in the city, especially, I'd be interested in hearing what kind of wildlife you have. I know that people like Irving live out in the countryside, so they probably have quite a lot of wildlife out there. But it's a little bit more unusual to see it here. Cleveland was a greener city with a lot more nature than Chicago is, but we still even get it here. Anyway, if you have any urban wildlife in your area, let me know. The email address where you can contact the show is tom@tomharrisusa.com. So I'd love to hear from you if you have urban wildlife stories or anything else. I do love getting comments. And the input that I'm getting from people is very, very gratifying. So keep it coming. I love to hear from you. People talk to me on Facebook. People talk to me on LiveJournal. They don't send a lot of mail to the main address for the show. But that's okay. Yeah, because I do actually enjoy hearing from the regular correspondents. So feel free to write. And even if it's something about something I talked about in episode one, you could go all the way back. And, you know, if you have comments to make on anything that I've talked about on the show, please feel free. If it is a comment on something in episode one, though, you know, put that in your message so that I can go back and listen to it. Because I don't always remember every word that I've said on the show. Speaking of comments, I had a comment this week from Dell, and Dell in North Fort Myers, Florida. And Dell is my ex-wife. And she wrote me a message saying she'd finally found some time to listen to the show, and she thought it was interesting. And apparently she's been listening since episode 19. So welcome to the club, Dell. And if you feel like participating in the show, sending along an email or whatever, please feel free. Anyway, Dell is a writer, and she's had a couple of novels published over the years. The first one, I'm pretty sure the first one's not in print anymore and is not available anymore. The second is available on Amazon.com. It's called The Angel Within, and she wrote it under the pseudonym Kraken. That's K-R-A-C-K-E-N. And she writes novels in the yaoi genre, so sort of gay romance adventure. I'm not really sure. You know, I haven't read the second novel, I'm afraid. I did read the first one, though. But anyway, you can go get that on Amazon.com. Okay, I did have some news on the job this week, and I haven't heard anything official yet, but it doesn't look good. What has happened, and I think I mentioned this in a previous episode, is that the company has kind of split up, and they're eliminating the corporate office. And I was offered the opportunity to go to one of the other locations, which would have involved a two-hour commute each way. And for the job I do, that just didn't really seem worth it to me. And I kind of said, well, thanks, but no thanks to that option. And this past week, they actually hired somebody else to do that job. Now, this person is going to have a week or two of training. So what I think is probably going to end up happening is that we're going to be training her over the next couple of weeks. And I know she has, you know, she's going to work with me sometimes, and she's going to work with my boss sometimes, and the other employee another time. And I'm guessing what's going to happen, though, like I said, I don't know, and they haven't actually been told anything. But I have a feeling that once I come back from my vacation, I'm going to be job hunting. That's just kind of where I think this is going. So I am trying to do things like go to the dentist, go to the doctor, all that stuff before I lose all my benefits. So, yeah, kind of a stressful time work-wise, but I do think I can do better closer to home. Because for what I was making and for the time that would be involved, I really don't think that the job I was doing is worth it. But, you know, hey, you know, I'm taking it one day, one week, one month at a time, as far as I know. You know, for all I know, they're going to keep me going at the job. I haven't been told anything yet. So I'm assuming, though, that I am losing my job when I come back from vacation. Now, speaking of vacation, now, that hasn't changed. You know, most of it's already paid for, so I'm kind of like, okay, well, there's no sense in stopping that now. So last time I was talking about the trip, which was like 3 episodes ago now, I mentioned I was looking for something to do for the last 3 days of the trip, because Paul's going back to London on the 26th, and then I have until the 30th. To go home. So I have 3 days open, and I've been talking about going to Isla. But what I've found as I've been kind of trying to make plans to do this is that it's just really not feasible. And it's not that it's expensive to get out there, because it really isn't. It's just kind of a pain in the ass, and it takes a little bit longer to get out there than I would like. Because Isla's not you know, right on the mainland. It's one of the Hebrides. It's the southernmost of the Hebrides. And you have to go out there by ferry. And the ferry port that most of the ferries go from is in a town called Kennacraig. And to get to Kennacraig, I would have to go to Glasgow and be there at 8 o'clock in the morning and take a bus, or a coach if you're in the UK, and that would get to Kennacraig about noon. I mean, it takes a good amount of time to get there. And then the noon 30 sailing from Kennacraig to Islay. So that would take, you know, the better part of a day to get out there and the better part of a day to get back. And that would really only leave me with one day on Islay. And that's not enough time. As much as I really, really want to go out there, 3 days isn't long enough. And the hassle that you have to go to get out there, it just isn't worth it. Now, I could have flown, and I did look into that, but the price for flying out there is about £120. I mean, not a lot of money, really. But, again, it's kind of a drag to have to do that. So I want to give Islay more time. I want to give Islay at least, you know, 3, 4, 5 days that I can really explore the island, because I love the island so much, and I really kind of hate to go in and give it short shrift. So I've been pondering other options. Irving Distiller suggested I go to a place called, I believe it's called Ardvariki, and it's this big, really huge estate set on a lot of land. It's super, super expensive to stay there, but the setting is just incredibly gorgeous. As you know, it's in the Scottish Highlands, so of course it's gorgeous. I love the Highlands. And he suggested I stay in a nearby town called Newtonmore, and I looked into that too. And it's more reasonable. Still a little bit pricey, and I think it's because it's a very kind of very tony environment there, very posh. But what I've decided to do instead, I think, is I'm going to go down to Gloucestershire in the Cotswolds. And I've been there before, so it's not really breaking any new territory. There's very few places in the UK that I haven't yet been to. And I don't really want to hike for those last 3 days because, you know, Paul and I will have just spent, you know, 6 days crossing the UK on foot. So I'm not going to really feel like hiking. So I thought what I might do is go down to Gloucester and maybe try to do some digging. Now, I have an ancestor. It's actually my immigrant ancestor from the UK, a guy named Robert Harris. Tradition holds that he was from Gloucestershire. Never been able to find any concrete evidence. But I thought what I might do is go down there, and I'm going to be there on 2 weekdays. So what I thought I might do is go to the Gloucestershire Records Office, where they have a lot of the local history resources, and see what I can dig up, if anything. I mean, you know, I don't mind spending days in archives or whatever. I mean, I've done it before. I think I am going to do that. I go down to Gloucester, and the Cotswolds are also a very nice part of the country. And I have friends that live not too far from there in Glastonbury, and I maybe try to, you know, hook up with them and you know, have dinner or something. But I think that's what I'm going to do. And so what that'll mean is that I just leave Carlisle on the same day as my best friend. I mean, we'll both leave on the same train probably. And then either he or I will have to change in Birmingham. And he'll go on to London, and I'll go on to Gloucester. And that actually will make it, you know, for a nice daytime train ride, as opposed to a nighttime train ride where you really can't see anything. But, you know, a nice train ride through the countryside, that'll be nice. And also, I will be closer to London. I won't have as far to go to get back to my flight. So that's the plan. That right now is I'm going to do that. I'm going to go to Gloucester, spend my last few days there, and then back to London on the 29th, stay in London overnight on the 29th, and go out on the 30th to come home. So that's what's going on with the trip. Now, what exactly I'm going to have to spend on the trip, well, that remains to be seen. But I look at it this way. You know, we have our, you know, my tickets are already paid for. I am going to be getting a BritRail pass because I'm finding that that's actually cheaper than doing the point-to-point tickets. and the advantage of the BritRail pass, and you know, get the Flexi pass so that I can travel any 3 days within 2 months, is that I can travel at any time of the day. You know, the way the train tickets are in the UK now, and Chris Reardon was talking about this on his show, so this will be repeated if you listen to his show. But they now have three classes of tickets, and there's the most expensive, which is the travel anytime ticket, and then there's the advanced tickets, which are the cheapest, and then there's one in the middle, which I think is off peak, which is more expensive than the advanced tickets. But the nice thing about the BritRail pass is that I can travel on any train. And that actually pays for itself with just the trip between London and Newcastle. So, yeah, it's more than a good deal. It's like I'd be stupid not to do it. So that's what I'm going to do there. So anyway, the trip is pretty much complete. I'm pretty clear on what, you know, we're going to be doing and what we're going to be seeing. Kind of wrap it up with a nice little visit to the Cotswolds. So that'll be fun. I'm looking forward to that, even if I have to job hunt when I come back. Okay, so let's move on to some comments. I actually have had some kind of building up here. The first comment comes from Doug DeLoyer, and I have a couple from him, but the first one has actually been kind of sitting here for a while. Doug says, I just got done listening to podcast number 25. Looking forward to your talk about Noah in the upcoming podcast. Used to read about creation science years ago, but kind of lost touch with it now. But back then, my opinion of it is that it mostly did more harm to Christianity than good. Well, thank you, Doug, for that. I kind of was reading about creation science a long time ago, too. And I think my introduction to it was Dwayne Gish's book, which was called Evolution, The Fossils Say No. And I think that was published probably in 1975 or something. It was quite a long time ago now. Now, even at the time, when I was a Christian in the late 70s and early 80s, I would have been sympathetic to Dwayne Gish's message. But that book always irked me. It just didn't seem intellectually honest to me. And in fact, as time has gone on, all of his presuppositions about the fossil record have been proven to be false. I mean, I'd be very surprised if even the creationists, who are known for holding on to really bad ideas for forever, I'd be very surprised if that book were still in print. He may have put it out in a new edition, I guess, maybe revised or stuff. But most of the assumptions that he made about the fossil record have been proven wrong. And I suppose you could say that for most of creationism, but that was my introduction to creationism, and I wasn't convinced by it. There were other books that I read in that same time which I thought were better, and I did read Whitcomb and Morris when they're talking about I think the book was called Creation Science, and it came out in 1968 or 1969. I have to say, yeah, I agree with you. I think it does do more harm to Christianity than good, because people realize now, especially as time has gone on and science has progressed and more evidence has been found that doesn't support a young Earth. And the fact that they cling to that out of desperation, it seems, and they just ignore any evidence that's contrary to what the Bible says. They just ignore it. And you can't do that if you want to be taken seriously as a scientist. I mean, you want to create, if you actually are a scientist, creation scientist or not, you want to assemble data. And if you ignore data, it's not going to help you. It's not going to do anything for you at all. But clinging to old science or clinging to presuppositions that have been proven wrong a long time ago, yeah, that does nothing but harm their case. And you kind of wonder in how much denial the creation scientists are. While I was researching episode 27, I came across a comment that was made by Carl Baugh. And Carl Baugh was behind the Mantrax hoax in Glen Rose, Texas, the Pluxee River Mantrax. And you could go online and look up all that, or I can explain it on a later show if people are interested. But when pointed out to him that his timeline for Noah's flood actually happens during a time when there were already firmly established civilizations on Earth. Karl Baugh's reaction was not to say, oh, well, gosh, you know, my figures must be off or whatever. His comment was, well, then obviously history has it wrong. Because to him, you know, if anything that contradicts the Bible is by definition wrong. And I had another message from Doug, and this is from a couple days later after he had been able to hear episode 26. And Doug says here, people should not use science to prove their religion is true. And as far as creationism goes, it seems like a lot of it is speculation to try and make things fit. And science theories are based on God's creation anyway, so no matter. You accept Jesus into your life by faith, and how you conduct yourself in life is not between you and the church you go to, but between you and God. Okay, yeah, I'll accept that. I agree with you. You know, people should not use science to prove that their religion is true. For one thing, it's not usually possible to do so. And the amount of evidence that against the religion, if you use scientific evidence, is so overwhelming that it really is a matter of cherry picking if you're going to try to prove that your religion is true. So the more you cherry pick, the more people are going to see. You're picking and choosing what to believe. Now, people do this in religion anyway, and I talked about that on a previous episode. I agree with you here that, you know, the creationism is based on speculation and trying to make things fit. One of the problems, though, and this is true of most of the creationist organizations out there, the ICR and a number of others, is that they won't accept any conclusion that would cast doubt on the inerrancy of the Bible. As a matter of fact, the ICR, which is the group created by Henry Morris, they actually force, or I don't know if they force them, but the quote-unquote scientists who work for them, whether it's Duane Gish or Karl Baugh or any of the others, they have to sign a statement of faith which says that nothing they find will contradict the Bible. I mean, that's obviously not science, because the science, you know, they would want to, they would be trying to disprove each other's theories and so forth. I mean, that's what scientists do. That's why science is so robust. And, you know, occasionally scientists get it wrong. There's no doubt about that. But when they do, it's always corrected by other scientists. And the overwhelming tactic that the creationists and the young earthers tend to use is not to present an alternative hypothesis or an alternative theory. There is no theory of creation, and occasionally creationists have been asked to produce one. They try to base their entire argument on tearing down science and saying, well, we don't like this part, we don't like this part. And they think that they're making an impact, but in reality, they're just nitpicking. And that's all they can do, because they don't actually do any real science of their own. So I do need to apologize here. This is a little bit of a mea culpa. A friend of mine posted a message on Facebook, and I sort of paraphrased it when I read it out on the show the other day. And part of that was being in a hurry and lack of time, and I didn't really read it as it was written. And in doing so, I think I probably misrepresented what he was saying a little bit. And so to correct that, I want to read out his commentary in full. It's a friend of mine, Matthew, who lives in Chicago. Poking holes in Christianity is like kicking a blind man. Sure, it's fun, but it's just so easy, and it never really changes anyone's mind. It just initiates dialogue, which seems to be exactly what they want. Have you noticed this as well? And my comment to him is, yes, but I'm not against Christianity per se. I'm just trying to make people think about what they're expected to believe. And that is the case. I mean, I don't want it to seem as though Matthew was attacking Christians, because he really wasn't. He is saying that it is easy to poke holes in Christianity. Now, I always say, and I try to hold true to this, and if I sometimes fail, that's my own failing, but I criticize ideas, not people. So I do want to make that very clear. So I do apologize to Matt. I don't think he listens to the show, but I do want to quote him accurately. Mystery Woman, all the way from London in the UK. It looks like Mystery Woman and I might be having our coffee after all. That'll be cool. So Mystery Woman had this to say. And she writes, I think we're on the same page on this subject, and the subject there is creationism, but reading from a different book. I don't hold with religion, but to me, science and spirituality are opposite sides of the same coin. I would never try to force my views on others because it's just how I feel personally. Well, that's good. Unfortunately, there's a lot of people out there who disagree, obviously, and they are trying to force their religious views on the rest of us, and they're trying to do so through devious means, because they know they can't win the war of ideas based on their ideas, so they have to try to do it through legislation. I mean, that's kind of why they try to pass these laws banning gay marriage. Because they know that they can't justify it through their religious faith. Therefore, they have to try to impose their will by legislation. And I don't think that science and spirituality are mutually exclusive. But I don't think that they're opposites either. I think they're two different approaches to similar circumstances. And science is something that has come out of observation of the natural world. Spirituality is something that comes from faith. So I really don't see them as the same thing at all. I view spirituality more in the realm of mythology. And like I was talking about last time, I was talking about how, you know, the ancient people they'd find seashells on top of high hills, and their first inkling is, oh, well, gosh, the water got really high. And some of them would, you know, make up stories about how this happened. And they'd say, oh, the ocean god got angry and he threw his water over the land and flooded everything. Or, you know, the great hero was fighting a monster and he actually pushed the ground underneath the water, you know, with a mighty blow or whatever. You know, it's a different explanation for something which science can explain in a reasonable way, in a way that actually is supported by a great deal of evidence. So I don't think the two are equal, and I don't think you can explain scientific things using spirituality, and I don't think you can explain spirituality, the beliefs of spirituality using science. But of course, there are many, many scientists out there who are people of faith. I mean, Darwin himself was a Christian. Now, the fact that he found himself doubting his faith as the result of what he observed, but he didn't actually expect to find that. So anyway, I think it's unfair and also inaccurate when creationists try to paint Darwin as being anti-Bible or anti-God or anti-religion, because that really isn't the case. Darwin was a scientist. And on questions of faith and things like the existence of God, science is largely neutral. Now, we can, as scientists, go look at the evidence in the universe and say, well, there really isn't any evidence that there's any kind of God. But that's not the same as being how the creationists often portray science, and particularly evolution. They try to paint it as some sort of weird anti-religion, as sort of an evil philosophy which is responsible for all sorts of evil in the world, like Nazism and communism and every kind of ism you could possibly imagine. And, of course, you know, evolution doesn't say any such thing, because science doesn't have a philosophy. It's not dogmatic. I talked about this in episode number 26. So it is kind of frustrating. And so these attempts to try to portray science as some sort of weird cult is completely ridiculous. And it's wrong. And I'm running out of time. The email, if you would like to weigh in on the subject, I'd love to hear from you. The email address is tom@tomharrisusa.com. And with that, I'm going to wrap up the show. I do have a lot more to say, and we will continue this next time. So, thanks for listening, and I hope to see you next time.